It's typical for companies to want to control the narrative and to, you know, have a say in the spin of an article. That's pretty common pressure that's put on journalists all the time. But I have to say that Monsanto, boy, you know, they're the masters at it.
Hi, everyone. Drew Pruitt here, host of the Broker Brain Podcast. Today, we're talking with investigative journalists with more than 25 years of experience about glyphosate, Monsanto, and Bayer. Her name is Carrie Gillum. If you have ever been interested about how science can corrupt the government and try to sway public opinion when it comes to things like glyphosate, which are actually super toxic for the body, this episode is for you. Carrie is an incredible human being doing super important work. She's the author of the book Whitewash, The Story of a Weed Killer, Cancer, and the Corruption of Science. You won't be let down with this interview. Stay tuned.
This episode of the podcast is brought to you by BioOptimizers. So one of the reasons, of course, I started this podcast because I love helping people learn how to optimize their health. And many people are okay feeling just okay day to day, but with a few simple changes, you can feel freaking amazing instead. And why wouldn't you want to? Diet and lifestyle, super important, and those are the foundation. And certain supplements can also be really helpful. Because even if you're eating 100% organic, we know that our soil just does not have the same nutrient quality it did 100 years ago. So one of the key nutrients that's missing often from our soil and definitely in people's diets is magnesium. Most of our soil has become depleted of magnesium, so it's a tough mineral to get just through diet alone, and 80% of Americans are actually deficient in it. But here's the thing, it's crucial for hundreds of reactions, almost 400 different reactions in the body, and it impacts everything from metabolism to sleep, neurological health, energy, pain, muscle function, stress response, and so many other essential areas of health. So here's the kicker. I recently found a magnesium supplement I love from a company called BioOptimizers. Their magnesium breakthrough formula contains 7 different forms, which have all different functions in the body. Shout out to my brother-in-law, Dr. Neil Patel, who was the first person that told me about BioOptimizers magnesium. There is truly nothing like it on the market. I really noticed a difference in my sleep, and I've been handing it out to my friends and family who also have issues when it comes to stress levels or managing their sleep. All of BioOptimizers products are soy-free, gluten-free, lactose-free, non-GMO, free of chemicals and fillers, and made with all natural ingredients. I love that they give back to their community too. For every 10 bottles they sold, they donate one to someone in need. Right now, you can get BioOptimizers Magnesium Breakthrough for 10% off. Just go to BioOptimizers/brain. That's BioOptimizers, BioOptimizers.com/brain, and use code BRAIN10, and you'll get 10% off this extremely helpful magnesium formula. I think you're going to love it as much as I do. Now back to today's episode. Welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast, where we dive deep into the topics of neuroplasticity, epigenetics, mindfulness, functional medicine, mindset, and more. I'm your host, Drew Pruitt, and each week my team and I bring on a new guest who we think can help you improve your brain health, feel better, and most importantly, live more. This week's guest is Carrie Gillum. Carrie Gillum is a veteran investigative journalist with more than 25 years of experience covering corporate news, including 17 years as a senior correspondent from Reuters International News Service. She's the author of Whitewash, The Story of a Weed Killer, Cancer, and the Corruption of Science. It's an exposé of corporate corruption in agriculture. The book won the coveted Rachel Carson Book Award from the Society of Environmental Journalists in 2018. Gillum's works now as a research director for the nonprofit The U.S. Right to Know and as a columnist for The Guardian. Her second book will be out in early 2021. Carrie, welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Big fan of your work, familiar with it over the years. You've published different articles and your work with the U.S. Right to Know. So I just want to say, first and foremost, thank you for everything that you've done. And for folks who don't know about you, this is going to be an incredible opportunity, not only for them to understand your hero's journey of everything you've been through, but for the larger reason of why you went through it. But before we jump in and talk about origin story, tell us a little bit about Rachel Carson. You won the prestigious Rachel Carson Book Award. Some people know the name of her book, but not everybody knows who she was. So tell us a little bit about Rachel Carson.
Oh my gosh. Yes. I'm wondering, you can't see, I guess, behind me, or can you? I have a picture of Rachel Carson back there. She was a you know, brilliant scientist and author who wrote the book Silent Spring, as well as many other things, but warned us really about the dangers of unrestricted use of pesticides. And her book really followed DDT. You know, I think most of your listeners are familiar with that, the insecticide. And she warned us about, you know, the silent spring that could be forthcoming from these overuse of pesticides, the demise of the bird population and insects and people, you know, sort of the canary in the coal mine warning. And her work really prompted the formation of the Environmental Protection Agency. Yes. She was so, her work was so well regarded that it also prompted a lot of environmental defense organizations to become active. And sadly, she died from cancer, which we know is commonly developed as a result of exposure to chemicals and other harmful substances. So, you know, but her work still resonates. And I like to quote her a lot in my work.
Yeah. And you do it well. And, you know, it's great that, you know, we have such a large audience of different ages. And I just want to touch on one more thing with her work is, you know, there's this analogy that a lot of people know, even if they're younger, but they may not know where it came from, the canary in the coal mine. So can you explain what that analogy is for folks who actually aren't familiar with it?
Well, you know, basically, if you put the canary down in the coal mine and the canary doesn't make it out, I mean, the canary, you know, dies, there's something down in the coal mine, the fumes or toxins or something else that means it's not safe for humans to enter into, right? And that's really, you know, what we're seeing now. We're having a very dramatic decline in the bird population. In North America, and you're seeing it around the world as well, and we're seeing a dramatic decline in the insect population. And some scientists are telling us that this is sort of the precursor of the warning to, you know, a real apocalyptic event in our biodiversity. Mass extinction. And if we lose that, we're losing our ability to be healthy, and we're losing, you know, a healthy future for our children. I just wrote a column that should be out maybe, you know, today or soon, but about that. You know, we're so focused right now on COVID and this coronavirus and the viciousness with which it is, you know, just ripping through our vulnerable population. But we're not paying a lot of attention to why we are so vulnerable right now. And people really need to look at and understand rising rates of cancer in children and, you know, throughout the population, rising rates of reproductive problems, fertility problems, neurodevelopmental problems with our kids, you know, and all of this is to be expected because we're allowing so many toxins into our environment now, and they're taking a toll on us. So that's a lot of my work, I guess. And it's, you know, Rachel Carson warned us, and it's happening.
Yeah. It's which is why it's so important to do podcasts like this and hear from individuals like yourself who are covering this independently, because a core thesis of your work is that there's so much corruption and so much misinformation that it leaves people who are just trying to make the right decisions for their family, buy the right foods, protect themselves, minimize their risk for cancer, and just put food on the table. It makes it so confusing because you don't know what to believe. So let's start at the beginning, because you have a very interesting story. You got a call one day from your bosses and they said, all right, it's time to switch from what you're covering now in the world of, I believe it was banking and finance. And they said, we want you to focus on agriculture and up and move. Tell us about that and start us from there.
Yeah, I was living in Atlanta and I was assigned to cover very big banks publicly traded banks, and I was working for Thomson Financial, which later acquired Reuters. And I wore blue business suits and had fancy, lunches with very important people, I thought, in the world of big banking and finance. And Reuters, then wanted me to move to Kansas City and start covering food and farming and agriculture. And this company named Monsanto that was rolling out these genetically engineered crops and really sort of, changing agricultural practices fundamentally, making a very big difference with their genetically engineered seeds. And, I thought, I don't know. I wasn't too excited about it. But my father lived in Kansas City. I had familiar roots here and had just had a baby. So we moved to Kansas City in 1998. And, I spent the next 20 years writing about food and agriculture and really learning from the ground up, from farmers and agricultural scientists and agricultural economists and specialists. And I've spent a lot of time with regulatory agents, people who work for the USDA and EPA and FDA, and spent a lot of time with Monsanto and Dow and DuPont and Syngenta and the other big companies that affect agriculture and the way our food is grown. So it's really been an educational opportunity for me. And I've come to realize how silly I was. Banking is not the most important industry. Food and farming, we all eat. And what we eat is pretty fundamental to, how well we live and how healthy we are or how healthy we are not. So I'm very grateful that that I've had this opportunity and this has been my work for so long. Yeah,
I've watched some of your talks and heard you in other interviews. And you say that when you first started off, you were neutral. You didn't have any specific opinions one way or another in terms of agriculture. You were just beginning to learn and understand the basics, like you said, working from the ground up. Take us from there to when you first started to notice something that you felt there was a bigger story and that maybe the full information wasn't getting out there to the public.
Yeah. So I did get my education from many, as a reporter is supposed to do, from many different sources. I spent a lot of time, as I said, with farmers and learned about why they thought it was important to use chemicals and these genetically engineered soybeans and corn and cotton and canola and that sort of thing. And I spent a lot of time with scientists who said, there's some things that are not good that we need to really understand and learn more about. And then Monsanto as well, who had me into their headquarters numerous times to learn from their people about why it was important, again, why these things were so needed to feed the world. But it was the early 2000s when Monsanto was getting ready to introduce genetically engineered wheat and kept saying that, these farmers really need this Roundup ready wheat, this wheat that would be tolerant of glyphosate, which is a chemical, a pesticide and herbicide in Monsanto's Roundup products. And, as I started talking to wheat farmers and started going to wheat association meetings, I realized the wheat farmers didn't want this. They didn't need it. They didn't want it. It was not going to be helpful. It was going to threaten their export markets. But Monsanto was pretty much trying to force it down their throats. And I started writing more and more about this. And that just, I guess, opened up, a whole new view for me or world for me that, this wasn't about feeding the world. This wasn't about giving farmers what they were clamoring for. This was about selling more pesticides and more specialty patented seeds. And I don't know. And I just, as I said, as I learned more and as the science developed, it became a different story. And I was writing a lot more about the harmful impacts and the critics and the implications of this wholesale change in the way we grow our food.
So let's unpack a couple of the things that you just mentioned there. Let's talk about first this, a lot of people have heard the term glyphosate. The court cases have been out there. We'll revisit that in a second for those that aren't as familiar. But you talked about genetically modified foods and Roundup ready wheat. What's the argument and the pitch that, let's say, Monsanto, now Bayer, what was their pitch around these? What are they And what was their pitch around why the world needed these items?
Yeah. So in the 1990s, Monsanto became, you know, sort of infamous for rolling out genetically engineered crops. And they were these first crops, genetically engineered crops, were designed to do one thing, and that was tolerate a chemical called glyphosate. Glyphosate is a weed killing agent, and it was introduced in 1974 by Monsanto as a novel herbicide. It's in Roundup, it's in Ranger Pro, it's actually in hundreds and hundreds of weed killing products now, you know, sold around the world. It's probably in a lot of your listeners' garage if they, you know, spray it around their yard or to kill weeds. It's used prominently in agriculture and by school districts and, you know, industrial uses. Glyphosate is the most widely used herbicide in the world. Monsanto's patent was expiring in the year 2000, and the company brilliantly came up with an idea to try to keep control of the market and be able to, you know, demand a premium. So it rolled out these crops that could be sprayed directly with Roundup glyphosate, and they wouldn't die. The weeds would die, but the crops wouldn't. And Monsanto scientists were smart enough to figure out how to tinker with the DNA and introduce, you know, a transgenic, you know, slice of gene that could alter the crops in this way. And farmers loved it. I mean, they really did. It made their job so much easier to deal with weeds.
And you also say, sorry to interrupt, but you also say that it actually was a better pesticide at the time compared to maybe some of the things that they were using before that were much more toxic to the farmers.
Exactly. You know, Roundup was marketed in glyphosate as, you know, so very safe and affecting sort of a part of the plant, a shikimate pathway in the plant for the production of amino acids that doesn't exist in humans or animals. And so it was supposed to really just, you know, wipe out a weed pretty quickly, but to be almost, you know, totally fine, non-toxic for humans. And that was always the way that it was sold. So as I said, farmers loved it, and it replaced some much more toxic and much more dangerous weed killers that they had been using. So, you know, that was in the 90s and the 2000s. And with the introduction of genetically engineered crops, sales of glyphosate herbicides like Roundup did, you know, just take off and made Monsanto and other companies many billions and billions of dollars, as did the genetically engineered seeds.
When did the first concerns start to come out that maybe this thing that we're being told is super duper safe actually could be problematic?
Yeah. You know, there have been concerns just from the outset. I mean, there were concerns early on that by introducing genetically engineered seeds, you were going to really mess with Mother Nature to a degree that would have very harmful impacts on the health of the soil, the microorganisms within the soil, which in turn would affect the health of the plant. There were concerns about increasing the resistance of weed populations, which would, again, you know, make it necessary to use even more chemicals to deal with resistant weeds. There were concerns that glyphosate residues then would be left on finished food. So people who are eating their breakfast cereals or, you know, whatever else they're consuming would be consuming little bits of weed killer in their meals. And as the science started to follow glyphosate, we started seeing, you know, toxicology studies and epidemiology studies coming out showing that, you know, animals that were dosed with glyphosate, you know, had rare kidney tumors, for instance, or other problems. And we saw farmer studies in which that indicated that there was an association with non-Hodgkin lymphoma from exposure to glyphosate. So, you know, these concerns just mounted and mounted and mounted until the year 2015, when the International Agency for Research on Cancer, which is part of the World Health Organization, looked at all of these studies together and said, you know what, this looks like a probable human carcinogen that can cause non-Hodgkin lymphoma.
Incredible. Now, take us back to your journey and your reporting. interestingly enough, just to flash forward, you became a target of the industry. Tell our listeners about that, how you, and maybe even the first hit piece or when the first critical things that you started to notice in your process of reporting on what these researchers, farmers, and scientists were saying about their concerns with glyphosate and genetically modified foods.
Yeah, I mean, it Monsanto did a number on me, that's for sure. I mean, and this started way back, you know, when I first started writing articles about farmers not necessarily wanting Roundup Ready wheat. You know, they did not like that at all. And Monsanto, you know, it's typical for companies to want to control the narrative and to, you know, have a say in the spin of an article. That's pretty common pressure that's put on journalists all the time. But I have to say that Monsanto, boy, you know, they're the masters at it. And they have engaged in a whole array of tactics to try to ruin my career and my credibility. We were able to get our hands on internal Monsanto documents that show that they went so far as to engage a consulting company in Washington, D.C. to harass and smear my reputation. When my book came out, they had all sorts of things that they were trying to do to discredit the book so that people wouldn't read it. The Guardian actually has a whole article about the things that they were trying to do. And of course, what they've done to me is not singular to me or unique to me. We've seen in their internal documents that have come out through litigation that this is common practice. This is what they do to scientists and journalists and you know, pretty much anybody who just raises a hand and say, hey, what about this? What about this problematic scientific study over here? They just really want to silence critics. And we've seen that they have borrowed tactics or perhaps perfected tactics that were used by the tobacco industry to try to discredit researchers who said, you know, tobacco smoke can cause lung cancer.
And I think that's a great place to jump into some more of the details is that essentially Monsanto knew that there was concerns about glyphosate and some of their products. And they knew that the World Health Organization was most likely going to name them as a carcinogen, as a probable carcinogen in their findings. So even though they knew this internally, you found out later through court documents, externally, they were pushing a different narrative. Tell us a little bit more about that. Expand that more for our audience, if you could.
Yeah. That's what's just so amazing that, or to me anyway, or so jaw-dropping, is that this company worked so hard for so many years, 40 years really, to deny, to discredit, to harass, to do everything that it could in what really is a deceptive strategy. There's no really other way to say it. It was blatant deception on consumers and regulators and lawmakers and others. And you know, there's a whole you know, playbook for how they did this. They engaged in ghostwriting scientific papers. For instance, we were able to see through all of the information that's come out through litigation and through some Freedom of Information Act requests that I've been able to fulfill, you know, that they essentially would pay outside scientists to put their names on research papers, but then Monsanto scientists would actually do a lot of the writing and editing so that the papers would declare that there was no concern whatsoever with this chemical and that it definitely did not cause cancer. And then these papers would be given to regulators and they would say, look at these independent scientists who found that our chemical doesn't cause cancer. And regulate our own EPA here in the US has relied on a number of those papers. And you know, in some of the internal documents, in one in particular, you see them celebrating. You see Monsanto's scientists talking internally amongst themselves about how much work they've done on this paper for so long, and how this independent paper is just going to be great for them in defending the safety of glyphosate. And they're going to get polo shirts that are going to sell. They're going to get little celebratory polo shirts that they can all wear to celebrate this great, you know, lie is what it was upon the public. And to me, again, I describe it as jaw dropping. And when I was asked to testify to this to the European Parliament in 2017, when they were looking at glyphosate safety and whether or not they should continue to allow it on the market. And I said, and I still say this, I can't weigh in on, does it cause cancer? Does it not cause cancer? I'm not a scientist. I can definitely tell you this company has lied to the public for 40 years. There's no way to deny that. Their own internal documents damn them and show that that's what they've been doing.
I don't remember exactly the name of the paper, but I heard you quote it in a talk that you gave to the CrossFit community. And you tell about it in your book too. There was a pivotal paper that was the paper that everybody looked to say that glyphosate was not harmful. Yeah, regulators would look at it. Journalists would look at it. They would all cite this paper and say, look, this big study that was done, it's a fact. And we know that glyphosate. So it's like one side says, so it's like basically they turned into a he said, she said. Okay, one side is saying that glyphosate is not safe, but look at this other paper. It's saying that it's safe. Classic move from the tobacco industry. Talk about that paper and what you later found out about it.
Yes. So that, I think you're referring to the William Crozon Monroe paper.
Yes, that's the one.
Those are the three authors. So you describe it as William Crozon Monroe. It was published in the year 2000. That's the one that I was just speaking of, where you can see in the internal emails where they are talking about all the work that they've done on this independent paper, the Monsanto scientist, and then they celebrate and they talk about how they're going to use this to defend glyphosate safety because it's such a great and important independent paper. And we learned, I guess the first thing we learned about this paper was from that it was ghostwritten, was from an email that was written in 2015 by Monsanto scientist Bill Hydens. And he is talking to his team about ghostwriting more scientific papers. And he says, recall, that's how we handled William Crozon Monroe, bringing in outside scientists, paying them to just edit and sign their names, so to speak. And so that email really, opened up a lot of eyes, I guess, to see that. And then they did proceed, as we can follow through the document trail, they did proceed to ghostwrite another series of papers defending glyphosate safety. So they've been doing this over, many, many years. But again, that's just one tactic. We also saw through internal Monsanto communications that they were ghostwriting, op-eds and columns and things that would appear in magazines and newspapers and on websites like WebMD. We see that they engaged in ghostwriting a column that appeared in Forbes magazine, for instance. And, Forbes had to come out and strip that out and get rid of it. But it's been a carefully designed strategy for many, many years, as I said, to fool the public and lawmakers and regulators to believe that this chemical is safe. And anybody who says it isn't is just, crazy.
Yeah. And they try to make you look crazy. Here's an organization that sounds like a very legitimate organization. I took a screenshot from it. It's the American Council on Science and Health, right? Everybody thinks that, American Council on Science and Health. The title of this article is on glyphosate, Carrie Gillum keeps lying early and often. And then there's a photo of you. And then the article goes on to talk about that. So let's switch because, we talked about ghostwriting papers. Let's switch to the other aspect of these front groups like the American Council on Science and Health. What did you find out about them?
Right. Yeah. So the use of front groups, again, is sort of a tobacco industry, tool, part of the toolbox. And what we've seen through again, documents and being able to follow money trails is that Monsanto has employed this. The American Council on Science and Health is one of their favorites. We have emails where the American Council on Science and Health is asking Monsanto for more money. You've given us so much money in the past and we need so much more money now. And, here's all the work we've done, talking about how safe glyphosate is and attacking, your critics. And you see emails back from Monsanto saying you won't get a better value for your dollar than ACSH. And ACSH proclaims itself to be independent, to not be a front group at all. But they don't disclose their funding anywhere publicly. They don't disclose they get money from Monsanto. And then they do things like write articles like that, like Carrie Gillum is a liar. And they've attacked Eric Lipton at the New York Times and Danny Hakim at the New York Times. They are also liars. They've said that I'm an unregistered foreign agent for Russia, trying to undermine American confidence in the food supply. They've accused me of participating in a corporate extortion scheme for which, you know, someone else went to prison and I should be in prison. I mean, all these sorts of things. But they are presented as a legitimate, you know, independent scientific group. So it's again, an effort to deceive the public.
Switching to, you know, you're as a journalist and as an activist exposing all this stuff through just really highlighting what's there, what kind of toll did it take on you going through that process? Did you become a hyper skeptical? Were you ever afraid for you and your family? Like, just asking.
Yeah. I mean, it seems silly to me now to say it, but yeah, I mean, there was a period that I went through where I was fearful. One of the people that I knew Monsanto was paying, one of the people I knew who was getting money from Monsanto, sent me some emails that I considered to be threatening, you know, very late at night, sort of cryptic messages about, you know, I needed to watch out and the end was coming and that sort of thing. You know, so I did go through a period where I was very afraid. Now I feel silly, you know, I'm not a big, they're not going to take out me, you know, a little old person like me. But yeah, I mean, it does weigh on you. They have harassed every editor that's worked with me in the last 10 years. They put a lot of pressure on my editors at Reuters, made it almost unbearable to work there. In the past several days, I've been dealing with editors from The Guardian because they, again, are involved in pressuring editors at The Guardian over articles that I've written. They pressured editors at Time Magazine. You know, anywhere that I work or anywhere that my work appears, part of the tactic is to try to get the editors or other people who work there to not work with me. So it has been stressful.
As I can imagine it would be for anybody in that situation. Let's go back to the cases that many people have seen in the news and give us sort of the state of the union on those cases. And even just right before we started the interview today, you had an update that you shared. You know, we're recording the interview today on October 22nd. So talk about those cases, why they matter, what we found out from them, and any kind of updates, and kind of how you see them in the larger context of this greater awareness campaign to hold these companies accountable for pushing out false information.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the litigation itself. So this is Roundup Mass Torts litigation, I guess, is a way we can refer to it. But after this International Agency for Research on Cancer declared glyphosate to be a probable human carcinogen with an association to non-Hodgkin lymphoma, you know, the lawyers around the United States, plaintiffs' attorneys, and people with non-Hodgkin lymphoma started connecting. And you saw lawsuits filing being filed in late 2015 and accelerated. And we now have an estimated 100,000 or more claims, plaintiffs in the United States who say they develop non-Hodgkin lymphoma because of their use of Roundup or other Monsanto herbicides made with glyphosate. And, you know, a lot of the plaintiffs have died already and they're being represented now by, you know, their husband or wife. I talked to a number of the plaintiffs. You know, it's a really hard situation for them. They feel like they were lied to and misled and used this product wearing, you know, sandals and shorts because they thought it was fine to use. Some marketing materials, you know, pronounced that it was safe enough to drink almost. So the first trial took place in July and August of 2018. June started in June and ran through August 10th in 2018. And that was a man named Dwayne Johnson. He goes by Lee, lives in, now he lives in Napa, California. He lived in Vallejo at the time. And he was told that he had terminal non-Hodgkin lymphoma. He was a groundskeeper for schools in Benicia and sprayed Roundup and Ranger Pro, you know, regularly for his job, large amounts of very high quantities of this this chemical. And he had a couple of accidents where he was pretty much doused in Ranger Pro and developed this horrible, horrible cancer, non-Hodgkin lymphoma that manifests in the skin. And so he had essentially tumors all over his body, his head, his legs, his arms, his torso, extreme amounts of pain. And as I said, he's been told he's not going to live very long. So his trial in the summer of 2018 resulted in a unanimous jury verdict of $289 million, with $250 million of that in punitive damages, because the jury was just so outraged at what they saw to be deceptive practices by Monsanto. And we've had two more trials since then, each unanimous jury verdicts, each huge jury awards. One jury award was over $2 billion. And Monsanto, of course, is appealing. The news that came out just yesterday that we were talking about was that the California Supreme Court has declined to review Monsanto's bid to overturn the verdict in the Johnson trial. So now we see if they want to take it to the U.S. Supreme Court or not. The other trial verdicts, the two others, are also on appeal. And as I said, Bayer bought Monsanto in June of 2018. So they inherited all of this litigation, and they are now trying to settle the litigation. And they're saying that they'll pay roughly about $10 billion to try to settle the U.S. litigation. But it's not totally clear yet if they're going to be able to do that or not.
Why is it not clear?
Well, there are a lot of plaintiffs who aren't going to get a lot of money. You know, you see these big judgments, but this is another thing I've learned, I guess, about our U.S. court system. You know, a $2 billion judgment isn't really going to stand. It gets whittled down. The lawyer's fees come out. Medicare, any medical bills that have been paid by Medicare come out, and then taxes come out. And often these people are left with, you know, I've talked to a woman yesterday whose son is told he's going to get about $45,000, you know, and so they're not sure they want to settle. So that's the thing. A lot of these people are not sure that they want to take, you know, a few thousand dollars for what they feel has been, you know, years or decades of suffering. So, and there are many more people, you know, still using Roundup and still being diagnosed with non-Hodgkin lymphoma. So Bayer has a very big challenge trying to make these cases go away.
So even though these cases are there and they are, you know, civil cases, right? How does that impact the actual use of the product moving forward from here? Like, you know, I read another presentation of yours and you were saying, if anything, it's all kind of continuing to go up. More Roundup is being used and more people are still kind of going about their day. How is this affecting the actual use of this product, which is linked to one cancer and maybe linked to a whole bunch of other health issues that are there?
Right, right. You know, and that really varies from city to city and state to state and country to country. You are seeing other countries around the world respond to all of the evidence that has come out about how dangerous this chemical is, and they are moving to ban it or restrict it. You're seeing different states and different communities try to do the same thing. School districts that are moving to say, you know what, we'll take the weeds. We're not going to use these chemicals anymore where our kids play, you know, or people gather. So you're seeing that. We see emails in which Monsanto has been very worried about losing school business. They certainly don't want their weed killers to stop being used around schools. But, you know, you're also seeing this very big push and this very big marketing effort by the company, again, to say, disregard all that litigation, disregard all you've heard. It's fine. You know, keep using it. And our EPA has agreed with Monsanto and said, it's fine. Don't worry about it. We're not going to restrict it. And you see a lot of political arm twisting going on. Thailand, for instance, last year decided to ban glyphosate along with a couple of other harmful chemicals used in food production. And they were specifically worried about the residues that remain in the food that people consume. But we see again through internal documents that have come out that Bayer went to our government agencies, State Department and elsewhere, and basically said, you need to make this ban on glyphosate go away. And our U.S. government jumped in and put the squeeze on Thailand, and the other two chemicals got banned, but not glyphosate. So, you know, very powerful company with a lot of influence.
Yeah. And, you know, this influence has peddled over multiple administrations, right? Republican or Democrat. Have you seen anything different, you know, with an election coming up? Have you seen anything different with the current administration in terms of the level of severity of that influence playing in, or is it pretty much business as normal?
Definitely not business as normal. I mean, the one thing I'd say about the Trump administration is that they don't try to hide it nearly as much. They don't try to, you know, smooth it out, or they're just pretty brazen about it. You know, yeah, we're going to help companies and, you know, we're going to help them do business, and that's good for the economy, and the calculus of, you know, human health, you know, that is less of a priority than the calculus of corporate health. And they're pretty bold and brazen about it. So, you know, I don't know, do you admire that more or less than, you know, an Obama administration or other Democratic or other Republican administrations that also gave a green light to this chemical? So, you know, we have, again, more documents that show Monsanto and Bayer sent representatives, sent consultants to the White House to gauge their level of, you know, backing and support. And we're told, we've got your back on glyphosate. Don't worry about, you know, regulations. We've got your back on this. And, you know, they certainly do. And it's not just glyphosate. I mean, a lot of, you know, when I talk to people about this, I like to reference glyphosate as sort of the poster child for a bigger problem. This by no means is the biggest, baddest, most dangerous pesticide that we're using on our food by any means. It is represented and sold by maybe one of the most powerful and influential companies, but it certainly is not the only chemical that we need to be very concerned about.
And this all highlights the larger aspect of the certain regulatory bodies. You know, people hear the word FDA and they think that that organization is out to look after us. Many people that work at the FDA, especially in very high level politically appointed positions, not that there's not scientists that are there that are trying to do the right thing, often will go to then work in industry, you know, afterwards with these really cushiony jobs. If you could wave a magic wand and you're looking at the situation that's developed over the last years and the influence these big corporations have and the decisions they can make that will have ramifications that we don't even really fully understand, many generations of ramifications, environmental, potentially linked to colony collapse disorder and bees that are out there. I mean, every functional medicine doctor that's been on this podcast is gravely concerned and feels that this rise in gastrointestinal issues that they saw in the 2000s is very much linked to the rise in glyphosate and other industrial chemicals. If you could wave a magic wand and have our regulatory bodies do something different or have different oversight, what would that look like?
Well, I think the first thing is you'd have to get the money out of Washington. You know, you have to take corporate influence and wealth out of the equation. Because when you do that, sort of, you know, the man on the street, every guy doesn't have a chance. We don't have a voice. You know, our elected officials, the Trump administration, they appoint who's running the EPA and the FDA and the USDA. These are political appointees overseeing these agencies. They usually are not sort of career scientists and people who are deeply invested in the well-being of the public. You know, there's an email back from 1982 or three, I can't remember now. I quoted in my book, but where you have an EPA scientist, just a, you know, working grunt in the EPA, looking at the harm that studies show this chemical can do to people. And he's trying to push back against Monsanto. And he says, our job is not to protect you. It's to protect the public. And that's what I hear a lot from scientists who work within these agencies that I talk to regularly. But at the top, you have political appointees who need to keep their bosses happy, and their bosses need to keep the money coming in from the corporate donors and, you know, the very big influencers. And as I said, if we don't change that equation, I don't know how we change anything else.
What do you think is more likely, that ends up happening and we figure out some sort of way to get money out of, you know, Washington, or that through your book, other people like that, this groundswell of sort of food activists and people that care about their health, you know, wellness is growing. What do you think is more likely, that somehow we figure out a way to do that, or that public awareness and education reaches such a groundswell that through shame and guilt and just, you know, putting pressure, that things change?
Right. Well, I mean, it all works together, right? It's the food chain, or whatever you want to say. I mean, consumer awareness, consumer education can lead to, and not should, consumer action, right? And that can be as simple as the food that you choose to buy in the store. You're worried about pesticide residues on foods, and so maybe you want to buy organic food, and that purchasing power then enhances the power of the organic company selling that food, in the organic industry, and the organic farmer who's growing that food. And that influence should trickle up, right? And hopefully our lawmakers, policymakers will start to pay attention to that. People might want to run for office. You know, I talk to a lot of people who are motivated to get involved, local politics or state, because they're so concerned about the health of our future generations, and they don't feel that our leaders are looking at that adequately. We talk a lot about foreign policy and economic policy and that sort of thing, education policy, but we don't talk about food policy necessarily. And as I said at the beginning of our talk, you know, food, they're what is more fundamental to our ability to live, you know, and be well, and for our children to have a future that's not full of sickness and suffering than the food that we eat. So I think that should be, we should all be really concerned and involved and educate ourselves about what's happening with our food.
Are there Congress people, are there members of Congress right now, or governors, that you feel are maybe not perfect, but are leading the awareness campaign on some of this stuff?
Again, it's hard to find somebody where you talk about leading it. I mean, Sheldon Whitehouse, is sort of a champion for the consumer, and is particularly, he's written a book and I think a treatise, and like he's been very vocal about corporate accountability and how corporations really are manipulating the system for their benefit to the detriment of consumers. He's been very outspoken about that. Shelley Pinegree is someone else. I mean, they're, you know, to agree, Bernie Sanders, I guess, has given a nod to this. And, lawmakers from California and some other places where you maybe have a more liberal or progressive view, I guess, have gotten engaged from time to time. But you don't really see, you know, a huge, powerful movement, I guess, I don't, in Washington at this point. You might see it at different local levels, particularly in communities in California and elsewhere. And you are seeing a move from a lot of farmers. I mean, there are a lot more farmers now who are trying to figure out how to grow food with less pesticides, with no pesticides, to grow food that's meeting this kind of growing demand. But they need help from Washington. There aren't a lot of subsidy programs or insurance programs for farmers growing food this way. There are a lot of programs that help farmers who grow genetically engineered crops or crops that use a lot of chemicals. But there aren't for a lot of farmers growing organically or regeneratively. And that is something else, you know, that should change.
Yeah, I know that my business partner and friend, Dr. Mark Hyman, you know, he just wrote a book called Food Fix and has been really trying to champion the cause and get anybody who will listen. Because one thing that, you know, definitely a lot of these members of Congress have have corporations in their pocket, you know, raising money all the time, other things like that. And they also just don't know. They get the talking points from these corporations and they think they have education on the subject, right? Just like a lot of farmers in the beginning, right? The farmers were well-intentioned, but then the companies went to them and said, here's the research, here's this, you need this GMO, you need this glyphosate, you need this. So you go on to spread that gospel as if it was your own independent, you know, fact-finding, and it's not. And so there's just so many people who actually just don't even know what's going on and how ridiculous this whole thing is. And I think that's got to change first before anything else does, so that we can actually have them make informed decisions and see the corruption for what it is.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, talking points is a pretty common thing that these companies are sending out at the drop of a hat. You know, I have emails in which they're sending them to the EPA. Here are your talking points, you know, for glyphosate. So
it's so true. So you know, let's talk about the consumer. Let's zoom out from the litigation, from the corruption. Let's talk about the person who's listening, the mom, the dad, the grandmother, you know, the young kid in college who's just trying to eat better, protect themselves. As you've mentioned, glyphosate is just the poster child of a litany of pesticides that are problematic and have reason for concern. When you talk about, I'm sure people read your article and then, you know, you always get the question of like, well, what should we do? Right? What do we do? What should we do? Is eating organic enough? You know, do people need to start? I know many functional medicine doctors that for some of their patients, they're actually testing their urine and looking at how much of these pesticides are in there, in addition to heavy metals and other things, because they're very concerned for their patients. So what are your recommendations for people for actionable steps they can be thinking about?
Yeah. And I'd like to try to answer that. I always like to say, though, as a journalist, that's not my job. Like, I don't want to be in a position to say, you should do this, you know, do what I say. Or I just feel like providing education and information is the way that people then can incorporate that into their own life experience and their own perspective, right? So, you know, the facts are that organically grown food is going to carry fewer pesticides, the residues of fewer pesticides than conventionally grown foods. And we know that because of reports that are put out not only by consumer groups, but by our USDA and our FDA on a regular basis. Most consumers are not aware that for 30 some years, our government agencies have been tracking pesticide residues in foods. And they do that primarily because they know that, you know, these things are not good for us in our food. And they know that when farmers use them, residues are going to be in the finished food. So there's a huge amount of data about that. Now, there is the position by the government is the position held by many corporations that certain levels of these chemicals aren't going to hurt us in the food. Now, it's noteworthy, and I've written about this, that Monsanto and other companies routinely will go to the USDA, the EPA, and say, hey, we'd like to raise the level of pesticides that are considered okay in the food. And the government will do that.
Right. Every year the ball, and I don't know about every year, but every year often it moves. And then people are saying, well, you know, it's under the levels. Well, what were the levels a few years ago? It's almost like diabetes. The levels that were considered diabetic had to change because so much of the American population had excess amount of sugar in their diet and they were worried about too many people being, you know, in that pre-diabetic space.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, glyphosate residues that were considered safe were a lot lower before the introduction of genetically engineered crops that the company knew would carry much higher residues. And so the EPA has raised those levels over the years multiple times to say, you know, this much is safe. Oh, now this much is safe, you know. But talking about these other chemicals. So, for instance, chlorpyrifos is an insecticide that there is, you know, virtually no debate left in the scientific community about how harmful this is to babies, to young children, to fetuses in utero with their mothers exposed to it. Residues of chlorpyrifos, either through dietary exposure or environmental occupational exposure, are known to damage babies' brains. And that's, you know, that's what the science shows. And because of that, Thailand, I mentioned, has banned it. Many other places have banned it. California has banned it, and Hawaii's moved to ban it. Our EPA insists that no, we're still going to use it in food and farming. It's fine. You know, we're going to do that. And there have been numerous lawsuits brought by consumer groups. The Obama administration actually said, you're right, we're going to ban it. And from agriculture, it was scheduled to be banned in 2017. Trump came in. Trump's administration met with Dow Chemical, one of the major manufacturers of this product. There was $1 million or so that changed hands for the inaugural fund of Trump. And lo and behold, chlorpyrifos is good to go. And we're going to keep it on our food and keep our kids eating it, even though our scientists are telling us it's incredibly damaging. So, you know, that's another example. And if these sorts of things concern you, you don't want to eat conventionally grown strawberries, for instance, you know, and other berries and things like that. These chemicals are used a lot to control insects, weeds, fungus or disease that can occur in a farm field. And, you know, they're found on everything, you know, kale and spinach and, you know, peaches and apples and, you know, all these things that we think are so good for us typically can carry a lot of pesticide residues. So that's something to think about when you're thinking about your health. But you have to, of course, incorporate, as I said, your own life experience. You know, what is your access to organically grown food? What is your budget for buying food? You know, who are you feeding? Do you have a medically fragile child, you know, or just yourself, and what's your priority? So, but, you know, it's an important thing for you to keep in mind. And I, like, my kids eat strawberries every morning, and man, I will go to 20 different grocery stores to make sure I've got enough organic, you know, berries, blueberries and strawberries and spinach and, you know, orange juice and all that sort of thing. And I have my milk delivered. I love that. Milk and eggs delivered by a local farm every Tuesday. So if you can do that, that's great, I think.
That's great advice. And I think, again, participatory, like community supported agriculture, having that direct relationship with your farmer, you know, outside of most major cities in the United States, you just go outside a little bit further, there's farms, right? There's farms. That's most of what the country is. Let's take this conversation to the current pandemic that we're going through. Can you chat a little about the relationship between, you know, junk food and some of the high rates of COVID-19, and in the context of what we're talking about here and what America's going through?
Yeah, I mean, there's a clear relationship between, again, between our overall health, our vulnerability in terms of our health, and the rate at which this virus seems to be, you know, killing people. And what we're seeing, data from the CDC and other scientific organizations and researchers, is that people who suffer from, you know, certain chronic health conditions, such as obesity is a big one, diabetes, and other chronic long-term ailments, are dying at higher rates from this virus or suffering much more severe long-term effects and implications from exposure to COVID than are people who do not suffer from obesity and diabetes. And we know that these ailments are related in large part to diet, right? And junk food, there's been a number of studies and implications that junk food, fast food, you know, chips and candies and sodas and Twinkies and things like that, you know, are a big contributor. And, you know, junk food marketing, unfortunately, there's a lot of evidence out there that companies marketing junk food spend a lot of their dollars in doing it to people in lower income areas, minorities, African-American, Hispanic, people, you know, who maybe have a lower education, that sort of thing. This is where they spend a lot of their marketing dollars. And so, you know, they're pushing this junk food, they're pushing this cheap, unhealthy food that's causing these people to be sicker. And then you layer on top of this is coronavirus. And, you know, it's just terrible. It's a terrible thing. And we should, you know, again, this should be a wake up call for not only, you know, how bad junk food is, but how important it is to be healthy overall. You know, our body is all we got, right? We get one body, And we need to take care of it and not load it down with toxins and chemicals. And for our kids, I mean, I worry most about, I'm old, but I worry about my kids and my kids' kids that they might have one day. And, you know, if you look at rising rates of autism, of neurodevelopmental problems, attention deficit disorder, you look at fertility problems that we're seeing in a lot of our young people, you look at their rates of cancer are up 34% in young people over the last 20, 30 years, I think it is. You know, 40% of men and women in the United States are now expected to get cancer at some point in their lifetimes. 40%. That to me seems incredible, insane. And yet we're all just becoming accustomed to it. We're all just, you know, 30, 35% of people are considered obese in the United States. We're all just accepting that. We're being led down this path that it's okay. And it's not okay. So I think coronavirus should wake us all up to that.
Absolutely. I mean, everybody knows now who's been listening to this podcast, we've had on different guests that obesity, one of the most common things that is linked with COVID, and many of these chemicals that are in our society are obesogens. They are things that when they get into the body cause us to actually become more obese and contribute to that. You layer on top of that ultra processed foods, which is actually, you know, the biggest killer every year, 11 million people a year, big paper that came out last year about ultra processed foods and how many deaths come from that. It's, you know, my hope is that in a way it's so unfortunate what's going on right now with coronavirus. And in the context of that, my hope is that this is a perfect storm of people to pay attention to exactly what you're talking about, which is, if we don't actually get healthy this year or these next few years, it's coronavirus. Then after that, it's something else. And we can't live like this. We can't live in lockdown forever. We got to get to the root of figuring out what's going on.
Yeah, no, I think that's the exact message that people need to hear and need to pay attention to. You know, maybe there'll be a vaccine for this soon. Maybe there'll be herd immunity. You know, maybe we'll figure this out. But, you know, who's to say we're not going to have another novel virus pop up here in a year or two or three? As I said earlier, the bird population is dying. The insects are dying. The signs are all around us. We are polluting our environment, and a polluted environment means poisoned people. And that does not bode well for our future.
Yeah. And even if there is a vaccine, which there eventually will be, we already know right now, most people who are experts in that field are gravely concerned of it working on individuals who are obese. It's just not going to work as well. Individuals who have comorbidities, right? And then if the virus mutates, you know, how does that impact, you know, vaccines, as we've had a flu vaccine and things have kind of, you know, every year it's a shot. They're doing their best, right? Scientists are doing their best. They're trying to figure it out. But ultimately, there's no better protector than actually genuinely getting healthy yourself, rather than necessarily relying on external factors.
Right. And of course, it's not just food. You know, I guess I focused a lot on food, but these chemicals and these contaminants are in our water supply. You know, our government researchers have found them in numerous drinking water supplies around the United States. Some of these pesticides, including glyphosate, are so ubiquitous in our environment that they're found in rainfall. So you can eat as clean as you want and drink as clean as you want, but gosh, if it's raining on you, you know, that's hard to escape as well. So, and air pollution is another factor. Again, we just, you know, I think we've messed with Mother Nature too long enough, and Mother Nature's not taking it anymore.
These same tactics that you've seen from Bayer and Monsanto in the field of the poster child, glyphosate, you know, we've seen them in tobacco. We've seen them in aspects of climate change, right? We've seen them in a lot of other things. Are there other fields that, as you read, even if you're not the one reporting on it, are there other fields or specific categories where you are noticing there's those similar tactics that are there, right? Are there things that you're reading that you're paying attention to? Is there anything that's happening right now in the COVID crisis? Is there other stuff that you read and watch where you're like, okay, maybe we're not really getting the full story when it comes to that aspect?
Right. Well, you've seen similar with oil and gas. You've seen it with the opioid crisis, certainly, you know, the litigation that's come out and a lot of the internal documents related to that. You know, we, again, when you have a pretty powerful industry that's making billions and billions of dollars off of products and chemicals that harm people, these tactics have become sort of commonplace, unfortunately, to, you know, pull out all the stops to deceive through science, through, you know, media, through social media. You know, there are a whole lot of Twitter accounts and Facebook and Instagram and everything that are set up to appeal to people and to try to present a certain message that is deceptive regarding these issues. So, I mean, I just feel like it's all around us now, and we really need to be ever vigilant, I guess, to try to understand what is true and what is not true and what is harmful and what is secretive messaging from companies trying to sell us something.
Mm. I do see, you know, similar to how we've been talking about pesticides, I do feel like one of the things that we're going to be talking about a lot more in the next 5 to 10 years is electromagnetic radiation, and not just from cell phones, right? Computers, other aspects, because we do know that some of these, just like pesticides, have been put in the category of the World Health Organization as a class 2B carcinogen, I believe. And I think as we continue to have more Wi-Fi, more other aspects that are there, it does seem to be something that a lot more people are paying attention to. And it's tough because just like pesticides, it's invisible, it's difficult to study, it's hard to kind of look at, but even more of a reason as we have more and more electronics, which is fantastic. We wouldn't be able to do this interview without Wi-Fi and all the great tools and technologies that we have. And I think a lot of good comes from them. It's just the question of how do we incorporate them safely and protect human DNA from being damaged?
Oh, exactly. And yeah, I mean, the debate over 5G, you know, is, there's a debate over fluoride. I mean, all of these sorts of things, 5G in particular, I don't know anything about it. You know, I know there's a debate. I know that I hear that I shouldn't be worried about it, and it's just crazy people and, you know, activists and outliers who are trying to, you know, have some politically motivated agenda. But then I think about, gosh, that's what they said about me. You know, that's that's what they said about the scientists at the International Agency for Research on Cancer. It's just, as I said, it's so hard these days. There's so much power out there working against our best interest, I think.
Well, Carrie, this has been a fantastic conversation. The book Whitewash, it's incredible. We have the link in the show notes, and I highly recommend anybody who wants to go deeper into this and really see the extent of the corruption that's out there. That's a great one. And also, you know, I hinted to the fact that you have another book that's coming out in 2021. Any bit of a preview that you could share with us on what you're writing about? And no worries if the answer is no.
No, it was a fun book. I hope people read it. It's actually called The Monsanto Papers, but it's a completely different book. It's about Lee Johnson, the first man to take Monsanto to trial, and sort of written like fiction. So, you're in his home and you're with his kids and you follow him through his legal journey to take on this very powerful company and all that he's going through with cancer and his attorneys and some, you know, behind the scenes sorts of things that go on with the attorneys as they try to strategize how to beat this powerful company. So it was a fun book to write. I hope people will read it. We'll see.
Well, when it gets optioned for a movie in the future, who should be the journalist that plays you?
Oh my gosh. There's actually already options on it. So we'll see.
But, oh, that's incredible.
Yeah. I don't know. I think I'm more interested to see who will play Lee. He's just an incredible man. I've met a lot of incredible people in following this, a lot of people suffering from cancer. And that's really, you know, really gotten to me. So the book is really for them to tell their stories.
I'd love to conclude on this final question, which is, are you hopeful about the future?
No. You know, I want to be, yeah, I want to be. And I feel like people are paying attention, you know, with all of the power in social media and the messaging that is so deceptive. There's also power like this podcast and other ways that we're getting truthful information out to people. So I guess I would just, you know, say, pay attention. This matters. This matters for your kids and their future. and your grandkids and great grandkids. So, you know, take the time, educate yourself, and, you know, do something about it if you can.
Yeah. You know, I like to remind myself after reading and diving deep in your materials that still most people on this earth are good people. They want to make a difference. They want to provide a better life for their families. They want to help and make their communities better. They want to give back. They want to leave the earth better off than they left it. And then there's a smaller percentage of systems, systemic systems that have just been caught up in corruption. And they're so deep that even the people internally can't see how deep it goes. And the one way, in addition to, you know, hopefully one day the government having our back on this and continuing to help us progress, is us getting educated, sharing with a friend, buy a few copies of your book, whitewash, give it to a few people and educate them. And one by one, I often think about like the dairy industry, you know, for years they talked about, now nothing wrong with people wanting to have a little bit of dairy here and there, but this pitch that dairy was the most healthy food and that everybody needed it and there was no concerns at all. And then people started getting educated and they started looking into it and said, okay, some people do well with dairy, some people don't. And over the last few years, dairy sales have plummeted. And that's hopeful to me, is that when people actually get the education and there's not gatekeepers that are there, they can start making empowered decisions. They can vote at the polls, but they can also vote with their dollar.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's the goal, is a well-educated populace, right?
Carrie, if our listeners want to keep in touch or follow your work or stay in tune with everything and the new happenings that are coming along, what's the best way for them to be able to do that?
I have a website, carriegillam.com, CareyGillam.com, or Twitter. And, you know, follow me at Twitter, Carrie Gillam. I put a lot of articles up there and documents. I'm a big document gal. So, you know, if you want to see original documents, you know, that's where I share a lot of them, are on my website, or US Right to Know, www.usrtk.org. So lots of places.
Fantastic nonprofit doing incredible things. And we'll link to all those items. Carrie, thank you so much for your work. Again, you know, so much of our awareness of being able to make better decisions is really through the work of journalists like yourself who are exposing what's out there. So I really applaud you and I thank you on behalf of everyone that's out there that's listening.
Well, thank you for your own work. You know, you're doing it too. So I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Just a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not, I repeat, it's not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or otherwise qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search their Find a Provider database. It's important that you have somebody in your corner that's qualified, that's trained, that's a licensed healthcare practitioner helping you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.